Hi friends, welcome to Interviews, Voices of Our Herbal Elders. This is my opportunity to talk to some of my dearest friends, people who have not only influenced my herbal work, but also have had a major influence on the revitalization of American herbalism. Most of us began our herbal work around the same time, in the early 1970s and 80s, when herbalism was still mostly underground, a place where plants actually thrived quite well. I love hearing people tell their herbal stories of how they began their herbal work, who and what inspired them, their favorite plant and healing stories, and I felt that others would be interested in hearing them as well. In fact, I felt it was important to capture these stories before this generation of elders passed on, as we're all destined to do. My welcome guest today is Phyllis Light. Phyllis is a fourth-generation herbalist and healer and has studied and worked in the field of natural health and healing for over 30 years. Her studies in traditional Southern folk medicine began in the deep woods of North Alabama with lessons from her grandmother and father, whose herbal and healing knowledge had its roots in their Creek Cherokee heritage. Phyllis is the founder and director of the Appalachian Center for Natural Health, which offers both online and in-person classes. She earned her master's degree in health studies from the University of Alabama, is a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild, and serves on the board of the American Naturopathic Certification Board as their educational director. And she is the author of the important book, Southern Folk Medicine, Healing Traditions from the Appalachian Fields and Forests. This important work chronicles the history of Southern folk medicine and its importance in medicine today. There is so much more I could say about Phyllis's accomplishments. More than anything, she's an absolutely delightful, wonderful person and an incredibly skilled herbalist. You can read her full bio on her website at phyllisdelight.com. Phyllis, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so looking forward to this conversation.
Thanks for having me. This is important and exciting work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Rodney. Yeah. So let's start with your childhood. You know, I've heard some of your incredible stories. And I know that, you know, growing up in the rural South really not only influenced your life, of course, but also your healing work and your work with herbs. So do you mind just sharing with our listeners just a little bit about that? Your childhood and, you know.
Well, you know, I grew up in a time period of kind of transition between what we call down here the Old South and the New South. And so I was in that transitional time period where there was still a lot of poverty and people were still growing cotton, and cotton was still the primary agricultural crop. So, like, my mom's dad was a sharecropper. So on my mom's side of the family, I grew up in cotton fields, hoeing cotton. We called it chopping cotton, not hoeing cotton. Chopping cotton and picking cotton, pulling bowls. And, you know, that was my early life, hunting. My mom's dad, you know, primarily was wild meat. And he also made a little extra money selling his hunting, you know, product, you know, whether it was rabbit or squirrel or deer, to other people. And, you know, gardening was huge. And on my dad's side of the family, it was a little bit different. We grew up in the woods and gathering wild plants and products from the woods for resale and to use for food and medicine. So it was all about kind of foraging, and it's still, because you're so poor, you don't have anything else. You know, like, my mom grew up in a cabin that you had to walk a quarter of a mile to get water from the spring. It had no windows. They had oil cloth. They rolled up and rolled down. The floor was dirt. And if they were lucky, they might find on the side of the road where somebody had pulled out an old bit of carpentine or something out of their house and put down. I mean, this was poverty, right?
Yeah.
And so both sets of parents and grandparents, this had been their life, and they didn't know anything different. I mean, it's just the way things were. You know, so I grew up going, yeah, we're poor, but so what? Everybody else is poor too. You know, no inside plumbing. But that was just our community. So nobody thought anything about it. So on my dad's side of the family, we hunted ginseng and pink root and whatever an herb company might be willing to buy. You know, and so every year we got a list from Chattanooga Herb Company, because they would buy stuff, and from Campbell Herb Company in Gurley, Alabama. And so my uncle, who was the businessman, my uncle Waylon of the family, every year would get together with the folks at Campbell Herb Company, and they would give us a list. Oh, we need ginseng. We need this. We need, you know, whatever was needed. And we foraged that. But my grandmother was also, had been, she'd kind of retired from a lot of this by the time I knew her, because she was getting on up in years by the time I got old enough to do stuff. In her younger days, she had been herbalist midwife for this whole community and wow. was still remembered as such. And so people would still come and go, do you have any herb for this or herb for that? So, you know, this is kind of like some of my early years. We kind of rotated between the cotton field and the farm and the woods, you know, and managed to eke out a living. And my dad also did odd jobs for people and construction work whenever anybody was building anything around, you know, usually could get on as a carpenter for a while. So that was just kind of our life. And we just kind of played it by ear, you know, as far as money went. You know, I remember us not having any inside walls in our house because we couldn't afford to finish the house and my parents couldn't. So my mom just hung blankets and quilts to separate rooms because it was wow. the studs were there, right? but over time, you know, and work, working, my mom in off season from the cotton fields, cleaned other people's houses. She was what we would call domestic these days, but she was a housekeeper and a short order cook in a restaurant, you know. So everybody did a lot of different things to make a living. And a big part of that was what can we find in the woods or what is on the farm, et cetera. So that was where my really early days. And like I say, it was a transition time period. Between the old South, which was the Jim Crow South, where there was a lot of racial strife going on. You know, I can remember roadblocks by the KKK. And even if you had a quarter, you were scared to death not to give them a quarter in their bucket because you never know what was going to happen, how they might come after you for whether you were Black or Native American. They didn't care. You know, and those were kind of like the only kind of different cultures in my area. It wasn't until much later that Latinos started coming into my area. So you were either Black, brown, somewhere in between, or white. Yeah. Right. And it was that transition. Yeah.
Such a childhood, you know, and so much to be grateful for too, you know, like learning the hard value of hard work and, you know, knowing what it's like to have nothing and still, you know, you came from such a wonderful family as far as people loving and caring for each other, you know, and, you know, that tradition. And it also just, I know, really, really deeply impacted your view of herbalism and health and healing, you know?
Yeah. Number one, it had to be really practical.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, it had to work. If it didn't work, you don't need it.
Right. It was like,
yeah. Right. Because yeah. It was like, this is all people had. You just couldn't afford to go to the doctor. nobody had, of course, this was pre-insurance era.
And nobody could have afforded it down there anyway.
That's right.
No, that's a whole nother thing. Yeah, I think it's wonderful also that you still, you know, you've chosen to stay in the South. It's like your home. You've been there your whole life. Still live in, if I remember when I was visiting, you said that this was a town that you grew up in, right? Or very
right.
Near.
It's a town I was born, you know, in. I was actually born down this street in the old hospital, which is now a retail outlet. But yes, I stayed in my area. And one reason is the abundance of plants. I mean, where could I go with? I mean, Alabama is the fourth state in the continental United States for plant diversity.
That's amazing. Yeah,
it is. I mean, there are over 4,000 species of plants here. And, you know, everybody still used herbs. Herbalism never died in parts of the South. So it never died in my area.
You were just carrying on your grandmother's work because you're still not only the community herbalist, your work has expanded out to the entire nation, actually, you know, both by, you know, by what the teachings that you brought. But yeah, so you've seen a lot of changes. You sort of were mentioning some of those in the South, but also as far as medicine, both herbal and, you know, allopathic medicine goes. Can you talk a little about how those changes have impacted the health of people in the South?
Yeah, sometimes worse. There are a tremendous number of people in the South who still don't have access to regular health care because of poverty and because they don't have insurance. And so that's still there, maybe not as much as in previous years. There are still, like, it's an area where people don't typically seek out a lot of higher education. Maybe don't even make it through high school. So that really hasn't changed. You know, it's an area where there's a lot of recreational drug use to the detriment. Not as bad as it used to be, but bad enough. You know, the opioid crisis in the South, and the South was the region it hit the worst. Was there the meth crisis? Oh, I mean, the next mountain over, they did a documentary called Meth Mountain that aired on TV. So, you know, that has been there. People, at least in my time period, had a garden. If you were poor, you had a garden. Now, if you're poor, you get food stamps and go to McDonald's. You know, so quality of food has just gone downhill. And that compensated for a lot at, you know, back when people actually had gardens and got good food in their bodies and knew how to cook. People don't know how to cook anymore. You know, it's like a big deal. You know, it's cheaper to eat fast food. So who cooks? Nobody. There's that. Also, the internet has greatly impacted herbalism and health, period, for everybody, because now we have Dr. Internet. And people will come and say, oh, I saw on the internet that if I have this situation that I should be taking this herb. What do you think? You know, can I get some? And I'm like, well, let's talk about that for a minute. That might not even be the correct herb. You know, tell me what's going on with you. So there's a lot more self-treatment without personal responsibility, if I said that correctly.
Yeah, you did.
So that's happening. And then there is something that I think has been in the South forever, and that is this kind of fatalistic view of health and the body. And I hear it all the time. Well, something's going to kill me. It might as well be this. You know, it's like, the doctor told me I needed to quit smoking. Well, something's going to kill me. And there's I've got diabetes. I don't want to do my medicine. Something's going to kill me. I guess this will be it. Or God's not going to bring me home until it's my time so I can do what I want to with my body. Because I'm just going to live as long as God lets me live anyway. And I'm like, no. You know, how about quality of life? Longevity. So that is still kind of a rampant view of life.
It is, Phyllis. You know, it also, that same philosophy also goes a lot on people's view of the earth. Do you know that?
Yes.
Like, yeah. It kind of ties into that same thing. Like, you know, well, God is going to save us all when it's our time. So it doesn't really matter what happens here, you know. So it kind of, when you were saying that, because I know that's also been a real focus of yours, is just, you know, environmental health and the well-being of the planet and how our own health is so tied into it. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Well, you certainly have your work cut out for you there.
Well, you know, I think it's not uncommon, all this stuff in rural areas all around the country. I mean, I think less so maybe in cities. So we have like city herbalism and country herbalism. And, you know, so I think that can kind of be all the things I said. You know, I see in the Midwest, I see it in Northern California, out in the country. I mean, wherever there's rural area, I think we get more of this philosophy.
Have you thought about why that might be? I'm just curious why that would be.
Well, I do think education plays a role in understanding how the body works, which is why I have had a great focus on understanding the physiology of the body, not just the herbs, but, you know, what is diabetes? What's happening in your body with diabetes? What happens when you like drink like a sailor and fall down drunk? What do you think is happening in your body? You know, but, you know, in an educational, non-threatening way. I don't want to make people defensive, but I do want to maybe explain a little how things work in the body, and then it's their choice, yeah, right?
You're very educated in that. It's wonderful. You know, it also might be because, you know, you have less of a fatalistic view if you feel you have more control or opportunities, you know.
Yeah.
That might be part of it too. Like, yeah, you know, so, yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your book, but also how you have made it your life work to, you know, bring Southern folk medicine out to the rest of the world as a really valuable system of healing. I remember one time I had invited you to be one of the, you know, main speakers, one of the featured speakers at the International Herb Symposium, which is really considered to be one of the most prestigious, you know, events in the world, really, for herbal education and herbal medicine. And you were very, very clear that you wanted to talk about Southern folk medicine. And you explained to me, I remember at that time, that, you know, it was such an important system in America and it just needed to be. And I, at that time, I really didn't realize, you know, it was like really through your education, I began to understand what an important system it was of its own. So if you don't mind just sharing a little bit about, you know, about your work of bringing Southern folk medicine out, Southern Appalachian, you call it, but really it's really that whole entire South, right?
Right. It's the whole entire South. Yeah. Right.
I know it's a huge topic, but just some insights into it and its importance in, you know, maybe what makes it unique and its importance in modern medicine, you know, in herbal medicine today.
Okay. Well, one of the things that makes it unique is that the South was the only area of the country, other than Native Americans, that developed the folk medicine that continued over an extended time period and was codified and passed on. So many people were using the same philosophy and principles, whether they were in Alabama or Georgia or Tennessee or North Carolina, these principles got shared. So we have a large extent of landmass and population using the same principles. And that is unique in the United States. That developed here, that developed in this country from the fusion of cultures coming together and the necessity of survival. So we have Native American plant use, and because wherever you originated, what country you originated in, if it wasn't here, you're using native plants or you brought plants with you. So Native American plant use and some Native American philosophies meets Europe and the humoral system and the humors meets some philosophies and spiritual healing practices from Africa. And it's just really unique. And now that potential also, it's unique to Mexico too. And actually, I've spent a lot of time over the years discussing the Southern folk system with the now Mexican folk system, where you had the Spanish, met the natives, met Europe, you know, kind of the similar fusion, but we have different plants. And also in Mexico, you have more of the Incan Aztecs spiritual influence that remained, where in the South, you had Cherokee, Creek, Seminole, or, you know, various tribes, and each little area kind of had their own tribe, their own regional plant, and their own philosophy. So one Native American tribe might have totally different approach than another, but there were some commonalities across the United States still. So that is unique. And the South was settled from the Gulf up. And so it was settled about 100 years before the Plymouth Rock thing happened. So the Pilgrims had not landed at Plymouth Rock yet, which is what our history books tell us is when everything started, right? It'd been going on in the South, in Alabama and Louisiana, parts of Texas, Tennessee, areas of Georgia, and definitely Florida for about 100 years. There was a big difference between 1492, which is Columbus, because this is where he came, the South, not the Northeast. And the Pilgrims were more like, I can't remember the date, but it was like
1592 or something.
Almost 100 years. The Northeast became the history that everybody looks at as the country, you know?
Yeah.
Right? But that was just the little area up there and part of the 13 colonies, which was all around the seacoast, the Atlantic coast. Right. But the Native Americans, by that point in time, 100 years down the road, something like 85% or 90% of the Native Americans in the South had already died from European diseases. It was a decimation. And for their survival, there was a lot of intermarrying started taking place between Native Americans and Spanish and Native Americans and whites. And there were a few isolated areas where Native Americans just kind of like Native Americans, right? But this is why the South in the early days was really kind of like already fusing. It was like survival. Everybody's survival kind of depended on it. And so here the folk medicine developed, right? Yeah. And we're moving on toward 500 years of this being here.
Yeah, right? It's amazing.
Yeah. So no other place in the United States other than strictly Native American can say that. And so over time, it became codified. And the information was shared around in the area because the South has always been a little isolated.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, the Civil War isolated the South even further. Plantation, living life isolated the South. Poor white people, very isolated in the South. You know, the Great Depression further isolated the South. Technically, the South did not recover from the Civil War and the devastation because all the battles were here, right? Right. And the damage to the land and the economics, it was like 1980 something before the South had recovered. So this poverty, this isolation was horrible, but it allowed this folk medicine amongst the poor white blacks and Native Americans to flourish, you know, and grow and be shared. So it is unique. It is a unique situation.
Is it still valued in the South, the herbal tradition?
Somewhat. I mean, it was kind of lost value in the 1990s and the early 2000s. There was still like some people like Tommy Bass, who had a big following, who was one of my herbal teachers. He lived about an hour from here. You know, midwives had been outlawed by that time. So now they're legal again here. So there was like this shift. Now the government moved into our area and many parts of the South. John F. Kennedy, and then later also Johnson, and then Carter as presidents, put money into bringing the South up in line with the rest of the country. And so government jobs became more abundant. Now you have insurance or the opportunity to buy insurance. And all the subcontracting that goes with government jobs, aid. My grandparents didn't have electricity. My mother didn't have electricity. But then the government came in and created dams along the rivers. And so there was this real kind of like FDR, huge amount of money put into the South to bring the South up to the educational and like just lifestyle living area that was common in other parts of the country. And now it's still not totally there in parts of the South. And truthfully, some people are like, just fine. I don't want that government aid, right? That's the other thing. I don't want the government in my life. I don't want government aid. But herbalism kind of fell to the wayside there for a whole generation. But then now it's like everybody is wanting it again. I mean, it's like super everywhere now. Amen. Everybody's foraging. Everybody's gathering plants out of their yard. It's back to kind of like the way it was when I was growing up. It's made that pendulum swing,
you know? Yeah, I wanted to mention this just amazing book, which I had the great honor to write the foreword for. Thank you so much. I actually love this book. And I would say that it's really recommended reading for anybody interested in herbalism at all. But one of the things, so there's a lot about it in herbs, but about herbs, of course, and the codifying, which I'd like you to explain that term in a minute. But also, the other thing I love about this book is you get the untold history of the United States through the yes. herbal movement. You know, there's so much history in here that ties in to the use of plants, you know, really all around the world, but definitely you see it really in the South. So yeah, I don't know if there's a quick story that you want to just mention about that. Just maybe one quick little vignette of the history that is so often not told.
Well, because the victors write history, right? Founding fathers up in the Northeast wrote this history of the United States, and it's a mostly white history, which ended up extending across the whole country in one form or the other. But for people who were living in the areas, it wasn't really totally what happened. I'm not saying there's mistruth there, but it's not the whole story. Let's say that it's not the whole story.
That's a nice way of saying it. Yes.
Yeah. The whole concept of land ownership in the United States in the early days was based on the concept of land ownership in Europe. And that just the whole thing of status and class came over here, but manifested in kind of different ways. But it was still there. Like the plantation system in the South was brought by the English from their experimentation in Ireland of trying to get rid of the Irish, trying to decimate the Irish population because they wanted to take over their land. So they would just kind of marched in, took over whole villages and towns and land and castles, and then started trying to get rid of the Irish because we don't want you here. We want to bring over the third son of this earl to run this place because he can't have his own spot. And so they developed indentured servitude, and massive amounts of Irish came to the islands, and the Caribbean islands for many years was the landing point for anybody from Europe, which is why, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean kind of thing, why there was so much pirating going on too. It was, everybody came through there. So massive amounts of indentured slavery. I mean, all this was taking place, but nobody is really looking about why it is. It's more like, well, that's just the way it had to be. No, it didn't. It didn't have to be that way, right? Mm-hmm. It could have been a totally different way. But, you know, the English were made a business out of it being that way. And here and in India and in Australia, I mean, everywhere that Canada, they made a business out of it. And it's important to note it was a business, and kind of England developed the modern corporation as we know it. But instead of stockholders, it was the company joined with the monarchy. So, you know, the queen or king got their share, granted land deeds status, but there was a company there too. So like in India, it was the British Tea Company. But it was the same thing, you know, that was happening all over the South. And it's just not a history that anybody cares to look at. It's like, this is how it got started. This is why it got started. And it was just all about money with slavery.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So it was just about money.
I think I found that I found the herbal information so valuable in here. As I said, you know, it's primarily herbal information, but I really found the history. You've done a lot of research. You also live it. You're there living it. You know it. But it's well researched. It's got tons of great footnotes. It's just a fabulous book.
Well, thank you.
So let's talk about the plants a little bit. I know you've had such a rich and wonderful life with the plants. And I always love to hear those aha moments, you know, like either when you just felt the plants calling to you, or you were saved by the plants. If you have a story of just something that jumps out of you of one of those aha moments.
I guess my biggest, I have two, one American ginseng and one false unicorn root. American ginseng is, you know, my family, and it was a family event, like my grandfather, my dad, me, my brothers, whoever wanted to go, great aunts and uncles, my dad's brothers and sisters, you know, my grandfather's brother. There might be 10 of us going ginseng hunting in the woods. Yeah, I mean, it really was the family thing. It's like what the family had already always done, and well known. And they had negotiated. My family had negotiated with landowners to be able to walk their land legally and get her plants. You know, because my family didn't own land, so we were at, you know, always had to be on somebody else's land. One aha moment for me personally was when my dad said, well, you've got to find the ginseng by yourself. Because up until this time, it was like my great aunt would go, hey, there's some ginseng over there. Go dig it. You know, and point it out to me. And I'm just over there digging green plants, or I'm running around in the woods doing other stuff and not even really looking at plants. You know how little kids are, right? I was like, I'm 10, I'm 12. I don't want to be digging plants. Well, what, go climb a tree or do, you know, that sort of stuff. But when I was a teenager, my dad took me out in the woods, just me and him, and said, you got to find it by yourself. You know, it's up to you. You got to find it. And so we went actually to a piece of land I'd never been to before. And it was a little gorge, kind of, and there was running water and a tiny waterfall, and there were just, you know, a lot of plants all around, and there was no trail. I mean, we were making our way through the woods. There was no old bed, nothing, right? Just woods. And of course, you're constantly on the outlook for snakes, too. So we're, you know, especially rattlesnakes when you're hunting ginseng in the fall. So you have to be on the lookout. And so my dad was a great reader of Westerns, the paperback Western. He probably had 1,000. I don't know how many he had. He almost always had one in his truck, in his hand, in his back pocket. Zane Grey.
Oh, yeah. Zane Grey.
Yeah. Gosh. So my dad took me to this bit of woods, and he said, from that rock over there, to that tree over there, down to the creek, to where I'm sitting. There are, you know, some ginseng plants. You've got to pick them out. And he pulled out that paperback book and he sat down at the base of the tree and he started reading. And I'm like standing there going, what? You know, because it's kind of an area of the woods where everything is knee high and green. Right. And like, how do I find it? So I'm walking around. I've been looking and I look at him because time is passing. And I said to him, are you sure there's ginseng plants here? And he was like, yeah. And my dad ate what he called dinner. We call lunch, but dinner was the noon meal. Supper was the evening meal. At 11 o'clock every day, like clockwork, because he had breakfast at 6. 11 o'clock, he's ready for dinner.
Dinner.
Right? And he said, well, you better hurry up because your mama's cooking dinner and she will be mad if we're late. And she would. She wanted us walking in the door when the food went on the table.
Yeah.
Because it was a full meal. It was vegetables, meat, cornbread. It was, you know, it was a full meal. And so I was getting really, really frustrated. And I was getting resentful a little bit with my frustration. And then I just took a moment and I just like stood still. And I just let out a breath and I closed my eyes. And I just started listening to the sounds of the forest. And I could hear the birds and I could hear the water. I could hear squirrels in the trees. I could hear animals that I didn't even know what they were, but I could hear noises, you know? But what really struck me was the sound of the water kind of moving over some rocks and a kind of little creek that went into the bigger creek. And I just stood there. And then when I opened my eyes, it was like while I was standing there in the silence, just being and not trying to force it, just being part of the process, it was like I moved into this different, almost meditative state.
Yeah.
Of joining. And when I opened my eyes, it was like the ginseng plants were just kind of outlined in light. And I was like, here's one. And my dad, being raised with some Native American ancestry, stood up, said, okay, well, let's go home and eat dinner, put his book in his back pocket and started back through the woods. And I'm like, okay. But that's the way he taught. That's the way my grandmother taught. You did your job. You don't get any praise. Praise? No. This was the expectation. Nobody's going to, you know, it was just, it's a different way of teaching.
And, oh, yeah.
You're right. And he just headed off in the woods and I went trotting behind him. And that was it. But it was that moment. And it was a teaching that taking a moment, moving into the land, hearing everything that I've carried forward to me, with me forever. I remember one time at an herb conference at a plant walk. I wasn't teaching it. I was following. I wasn't part of another, you know, the group. And everybody went walking into the woods. And I stood there for a moment and I listened. And they said, aren't you coming? And I said, nope, there's chiggers in there. Everybody came out with chiggers. Like hours later, people were going like, I got chiggers all over me. And I'm like, yeah, not me. Because I listened.
Because you listened.
Because yeah. I listened. And I'm like, nope. And that little thought just came in, chiggers. One time I was out in the woods and I was looking for a plant. I didn't know what I was looking for. Because sometimes, you know, when somebody is sick or you feel like there's a plant that's missing and you can't quite get it. You can research, but that's not the knowing. So it's the know-how I seek.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So yeah. I was just walking out in the woods And I just did the standing there and like connected for just that minute and opened my eyes and started moving. And there was false unicorn horn in bloom, the plume up and leaning over, the only spot in the whole forest where light shone directly on it. It was just illuminated. And I was like, okay, I get chill bumps even thinking about that one. I was like, that moment of quietness I always seek with the land. And I try to seek it in other aspects of my life, but it doesn't quite come so easily dealing with family sometimes or dealing with clients or dealing with, you know, the rest of the world. Right. Have to work a little harder to get that. But I think because of that early teaching from my dad, when I'm moving to the land, it's now like a breath. It's almost instantaneous.
Thank you, Phyllis. That story is such an incredibly powerful story because it really is the heart of really connecting with the plants, you know, and all the magic that happens when we do that. You know, it's like, you're right. It's not learning from the head. It's really learning from your heart.
Yeah. Yes,
it is. You had some amazing teachers, you know, like your grandmother and your father, you know, were really powerful. And I know that you studied with other elders. Is there any teacher or teachers that particularly influenced your work? Or
I guess I would have to say Tommy Bass influenced my work greatly. You know, he died in 1996. I was quite young and my grandmother had already died, and, you know, and I was just kind of like feeling my way, and my dad could only take me so far. And then Tommy had, definitely Southern folk medicine point of view on things. And this is the only thing he had done his whole life. And, he really helped keep Southern folk medicine alive in our part of the world too. He taught me a different way of kind of like not looking at the plants. He didn't have that like native approach like of quietness like my dad did. But he had more of a body system approach that he had been taught very early on. And you know, like this herb is good for the liver. This herb, you know. So my grandparents and my dad didn't have that. They were more looking at like these patterns of dysfunction in the body. And you explain what's wrong. And my grandmother was like, oh, that's like, oh. My grandmother would be like, and I've heard my dad say something similar. Somebody say, I have a stomach ache. And my grandmother would go, does it hurt? And they would go, yeah. And she'd go, does it feel like there's a squirrel in there crawling around? Or, you know, or does it feel like there's a snake moving around in there, winding its way through? She related everything back to animals and the land, but it was kind of like in this whole area, People lived with the land, lived with the seasons, lived with the animals, and people, yeah, squirrels do this, climbing up the trees. Yeah, it feels like a squirrel's climbing my guts in there, you know? So I learned that, and I might make interesting topic of conversation sometime, but Tommy was like, had been taught a little differently. His parents had been herbalists from England. So they were seeped in the humoral system, but Tommy was born here and they had immigrated really early in their life, but they brought that English system with them. And then Tommy had worked and studied with Miss Molly Kirby, called Aunt Molly Kirby, in the Black community at the foot of the mountain where they lived. And he had studied and worked with her, and he helped gather herbs in the woods for her because she'd gotten just where she couldn't climb up and down the hills anymore, mountains anymore, to gather them. So he learned from her. And then he was just, so it was like this different system. So people would come to see Tommy, and lots of people came to see Tommy. I mean, again, a year, he might do 1,000 or 2,000 or see 3,000 people. It was huge. Seriously. Lots of people. And they would come like on a Sunday afternoon after church. And I'd be there. He'd be there. And people would pull up in his yard because he lived in a shack. And there were old refrigerators, old stoves, old bicycles. I mean, it was, he didn't mow. Everything was grown up. I mean, most people would be like, I don't even know if I want to drive into this place or not. Let's get herbs from this person. But he spent all of his time drying herbs, digging herbs, that kind of thing, right? So anyway, people would come and say, you know, my stomach hurts. And he would go, show me, where does it hurt? Point to where it hurts, right? And they would point, and then he would go, well, you got acid coming up your throat, you know? So he had like this different view of this pattern of dysfunction, not really, you know, my grandmother had the animals and kind of like this common language, folk language of the land. Tommy had this humoral system. The old English humoral system kind of met the black folk medicine. He just asked different questions. So that was different. And most people didn't, I mean, in 15 or 20 minutes, Tommy was like, oh, you need this herb, and would send people on his way. Or he'd say, let me put together this formula for you, and you can come back and get it tomorrow. Or if you want to sit over there and wait while I see somebody else, you know, me or Daryl or somebody put together the formula and then gave to him. So it was just it was a different approach. And so it was kind of based on a different background too. So
he was incredibly effective. I mean, he really, really helped people with, it's such a special privilege. I always think, you know, one of my elders was learning from Juliet de Berkeley Levy, and I kind of think of Tommy Bass as the, you know, the kind of on the same equivalent. You know, he was renowned for his work, and such a great honor that you knew him as well as you did. I mean, worked very closely with him for a long time.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I did.
There's a great book about him as well. I forget the title of it, but if anybody's interested, do you know the name of it?
The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill published two books on Tommy. Yeah. I highly suggest them both. One of them is A Reference Guide to Medicinal Plants. Reference Guide to Medicinal Plants, and it's all the
It's big.
Where the researchers went through and they interviewed Tommy, and they wrote down how he used the plant, and then they come back and say how Culpeper used the plant, and then they would say how what they found out in science. So it's really a neat one to have.
Yeah, that's really fascinating.
Neat.
Yeah.
And then there is this book they also published.
Yeah, that one's great.
Trying to Give Ease.
Yeah,
and this is a beautiful book. It's very beautiful. And it's about Tommy's life, his personal history, and how he uses plants and has his formulas in it. So they go well together. So if anybody is interested, those are two really good books about Tommy.
That's great, honey. Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to ask you also, just because I have been wanting to ask you, you know, it's, you were, after the Hurricane Katrina, which was so, you know, just a devastation for so many thousands of people, really for the whole nation, but definitely in that area, it was just one of the great tragedies. But you were supervising herbalist at the Common Ground Health Clinic in New Orleans. Right after that, would you just share a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, was for 2 years. I was there for 2 years. And there were four wonderful herbal women there. I'll have to give you names later. You know, I know these people like the off the tip of my tongue, and my mind went blank immediately.
It'll pop in. Don't worry.
Yes, it'll come in. You know, these things always do, because it's been a lot of years.
Yeah, it's been a lot of years.
But when I first started heading to New Orleans, the bridge at Lake, I have to cross Lake Pontchartrain, which is like this huge giant lake. I mean, it's huge. And I was driving over a floating bridge because the bridge, I know, had been wiped out, and I'm driving on it and it's dark, it's night, and it's swaying. And I was like, oh my God, if I'd known this, I'm not sure I would have came. You know, it was like a really kind of,
yeah.
But that's how devastated everything was. And for 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, because of the devastation, the state of New Orleans suspended normal medical practices. So we could start, and I was not the person that started it, and I would have to get you a full list of all the people that started it. A nurse herbalist began it, and I can't think of her name, in a mosque in New Orleans, in Algiers, New Orleans. And then she had to leave. And then the Common Ground moved into its own special building out of the mosque. And this all happened within just a few weeks. This was like 1 week to the next week, right? And then there were four herbalists, Katja, Rachel, Amy, and Jennifer.
Hey! Good.
I'm getting old. Started working there. Seven Song came and did some work there. And then I was there. And the board, because there is an MD, and he's the clinical director. There's a nurse practitioner. There's a social worker. There's a massage therapist. There's an occupational therapist. There's a chiropractor. There's an acupuncturist.
That's awesome.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And 99.9% of the people who initially in the early days were coming to the clinic were homeless, because everything they had been destroyed. They were sleeping out of the cars, being denied government aid. Oh, I can get on this soapbox about the government and so much about what happened after after Katrina. Other parts of the country were kind of going, not a big deal. You had to be there, you know. Violence was rampage. You did not go out by yourself at night. You had to go out in groups. There was no fresh food. There was no water. I remember the first time I was down there, and we were trying to get to a grocery store, which was far, you know, not in the area. And there was no public transportation. And a lot of people no longer had vehicles. And how are you going to cross this other bridge to get this other part of New Orleans where there's a grocery store that they're actually bringing groceries into? So it was horrendous. It was like a third world country disaster. And aid just wasn't coming in. Various herbal groups and organization donated product. And I was at still connected to Clayton College at that time. So I was just taking all kinds of stuff. We were making stuff. And almost everybody that came in, like I say, was poor, had lost so much of what they own. And the majority of them were Black, because it was a poor Black community to start with. And so it was a really hard time, but everybody did great work. I mean, it was like amazing work, and it was like this training on this other level. And because I was a registered herbalist with the Herbal Guild, and that was an important thing for the medical board to have. If you're going to have an herbalist, they have to be at least certified in some way. And so it was a big training on this other level about what a disaster could really be like in this country. And eye-opening to what happens in a disaster with the government at that time period, and Homeland Security and FEMA, various government agencies. It was like, FEMA trailers that were poisoning everybody. I mean, I could go on and on how the mayor of New Orleans, and, you know, he ended up in jail, was demolishing areas in the Black community, just tearing down buildings and structures so that they could build something new and get gentrified. There was so much politics going on, but we were there doing good herbal work and helped so many people in spite of this political situation, trying to help folks the best we could. PTSD. So many people had PTSD from the hurricane, from losing everything, from the government, how the government treated everybody. PTSD and diabetes and high blood pressure. I mean, can't get their medicine. Diabetic and can't get their medicine. Medicines weren't coming in, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I have been really proud of the herbal community these last 10 or 15 years, how almost every major emergency, you know, the herbalists have come in and set up clinics, you know, after the Pulse nightclub shooting at Standing Rock, you know, they go in and really have been working with the medical teams and with other healers, like you were saying, to create, like, you know, like usually very all free and, you know, readily available medicines that people can be using. It's been inspiring to see that, I feel. And I think that Common Ground was one of the first examples of that, the clinic in Katrina.
Yeah, I remember I was in the airport at Providence coming back from the Northeast Women's Herb Conference. I'm standing in the airport in Providence waiting on my connecting flight, and I'm watching the weather, giant weather thing, giant screen TV, and I'm looking at this hurricane and they're saying category 5, and I knew in my gut at that moment, because it was hadn't hit yet, it was still coming in.
That was Katrina. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
And I knew, and as soon as I got home, I started putting stuff together. I knew that I was going to be called in some way, or I was going to volunteer, and I immediately started, like, this is happening.
Thank you so much, Phyllis, for all your good work. Yeah. So I think I just want you to share, like, one of those stories where you have witnessed, you've borne witness to an herb, like either, you know, kind of doing its miracle, either on you, like some, like a time when it really healed you or somebody else. I always love those stories, you know. I call it bearing witness for the plants.
Yes, and it does, doesn't it? Might be an odd example, but it was like for a person who did not believe, right? Well, I'm not going to do that herb. It's not going to do any good anyway. So this person had herpes in their eye, which is really devastating, painful, and you can't have light touching your eye. You have to have injections in your eye. And they've been going and getting these injections. They had eye patches. All this stuff was happening. And it just came to me one day when I was talking with this person, and I said, have you tried St. John's wort? And they said, herbs are not going to touch this. Herbs are not going to do any good against this. And I said, well, you'd never know till you try. And if it doesn't work, it's not going to hurt you, you know. And just to appease me more than anything, they were like, okay. And they said, but I'm not putting it in my eye. I'm not putting an herb in my eye, because, yeah, they read my mind. I was thinking, I'll make a decoction. We'll do a little wash. And I was like, no, okay. And I had some St. John's wort tincture, which is this beautiful red color, right? Which to me is always a signature of blood. Like, this is going to get into the blood. And so I said, okay, I've got some tincture. And so they were like, well, how do I take it? I thought, you know, in this situation, I feel like smaller dose would be better than a bigger dose. And I said, well, we could put a few drops in some water. You can drink it, or you can just put it on your tongue. And they were like, okay, we'll put in some water. And I did. I got some warm water, about a fourth a cup. And I put maybe maybe 8 or 9 drops of St. John's wort and the warm water in the tincture, you know, and they chugged it down. In 20 minutes, their eye had stopped watering. They were blinking. They tentatively raised up the patch and did this, and they went, I can see. They went back to the doctor, like, the next day, because they had no problem. The herpes was gone. It did not come back.
Oh, yeah,
and that's been like 15 years. No return.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was so amazing because they weren't expecting it. Didn't believe in it, you know? Yeah. So, folks, you don't have to believe in a plant for it to work.
That's, yeah, that's so true. They just been doing their work for so long, right? They're going to do it no matter what.
You know, yeah. James Duke, Dr. James Duke, just love that man. He said, we were in a conversation once and we were talking about the evolution of plants on this earth. And we were just talking about it. I said, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter what your religious belief system is, whether it's the Bible or evolution, the plants got here first. And we were just talking about that, right? And he said, well, I'm going to take that a step further. And I said, yeah, what? And he said, they were here first. And they, of course, were here for our food and medicine, but all the phytochemicals within the plant. And he took it. He was a scientist, you know, he was a USDA scientist. He said, we, as far back as you want to go, I mean, evolve with the phytochemicals in that plant. All right. And it was something I thought I knew, but the way taking it down to this chemistry level, this biology level, and I was like, he's totally right. He's totally right. If this is all you have to eat, right, or these plants, it's like over time, over a time period, whatever is in the plant is automatically going to have a place in our body, right? And he also said, it was part of that conversation, he said, and this is why with our medicinal plants, not our poisonous plants, and he made a difference there, but the plants that heal, our liver welcomes them.
Yeah. Oh, that's right? A beautiful way of saying it. Yeah,
he did. Yeah. He said, our liver welcomes them. He knows exactly how to break them down and put them around their body to release them into the bloodstream. He said, when you have a synthetic drug, our liver does not know what to do with that. It can't break it down, which is why with some drugs, people have to get liver enzyme tests every 6 weeks because it's damaging their liver. And he said, healing plants don't do that because we evolved with them and our liver welcomes them. And I was like, what a great way to take it down to this science level, this physiological level. And I loved it. And I quoted him a zillion times on that, you know? So you don't have to believe a plant will work. They evolved to do their job, and our liver evolved along with this over thousands of years to welcome it to do its job.
That's quotable right there. Phyllis, do you I know you do, your favorite plant allies or ally? Do you, those plants that always show up for you, they show up because they just love you?
You know, I would say American ginseng is in that list, but blue vervain. And we have our own native species, blue vervain, where I live, Verbena brasilensis, which it is shaped differently from the hostata or the officinalis, but it's has a different kind of potency in the body. It's a native plant. And so much of what I know about how to use it originally came from, you know, Native American uses, but, you know, it can be used interchangeably. It almost always shows up when I need it. And if it shows up, I'm like, I either need this or somebody I know needs it. All right. And it's not a showy plant. And a lot of times people will walk right by it and not even see it. Don't notice it because it doesn't have massive. It doesn't have these big showy flowers. It only gets about 2 feet or 2.5 feet tall. And that would be 2.5 feet would be tall. But it always shows up. Sumac, if it's a good sumac year, I know I need to gather that one, or I need it, or our mass amounts of the population are going to need it, you know.
But the sumac, is the sumac the staghorn? Which sumac are you referring to?
I do, generally, I do the smooth sumac or the winged sumac. We have some staghorn, but it's not the most abundant here.
Okay.
So most often I'm going for the winged sumac.
Yeah. Because
it's always
abundance. Good to do that. Yeah.
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 So it's very, you know, so whatever is showing up is my favorite plant ally of the moment.
It's there.
It's yeah. there.
Yeah.
It's there. I'm supposed to be using it, or somebody is going to need it, or, right?
Yes. I know you have such a long-standing and endearing relationship with ginseng, you know, through your ancestors and because it's, you know, you're in that habitat, but it's one of the, you know, at-risk plants. So, you know, how do you balance that? Because I know that you're...
I don't think it's at risk. And I know we may differ here.
Yeah, that's all right.
But, you know, when we're exporting 45,000 pounds of it a year, where is it endangered? It's only endangered to American herbalists. I think we should reclaim that plant for domestic use and stop exporting it and so much of it, and let it be for the people on this continent, right? For us.
Solution. That's a great solution.
Yeah. So why aren't we using it? And because we would use so much less than 45,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Right. That's a lot of plants. That's like 11 million plants or something. It's a tremendous number of plants that are coming either out of the wild or being wild simulated grown or being grown under a canvas shade of some sort. Right. Why aren't we using it? Because we've been kind of told it's in danger. Don't use it. We stopped using it. But it's all going over to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Right. And that is not. Unless we reclaim this plant for our use and start protecting it for ourselves, it's going to keep going out of the country. The same with black cohosh. So the same with false unicorn. We need to reclaim our plants for us.
I think that's really good. I'm so glad I asked that question. That's something really to ponder and think about.
Yeah,
thank you.
We would use a lot less. The herbalist would be kind to the plant. And we would use a lot less, but the ginseng export market would suffer. So it's not, if you think about it like that, it's really not endangered. It's part of this whole exportation process.
We also see a lot more emphasis on that wood simulated, you know, it's wood grown, but in its native habitat, and also organic cultivation, you know, really trying to... get farmers and growers to grow it, you know, as crops, because it's actually can be quite lucrative. You know, it takes a lot of time and work. That's the thing. But those herbs go at really good prices. So it could be.
Which is why people are harvesting ginseng inappropriately in the woods because they need the money because it's going for a good price. So they might be harvested and it's still waiting until August, which is when most states kick in, now you can start harvesting, August to January. They'll harvest and, oh, here's a ginseng plant. It's only May, but I'm going to go ahead and get it. So if we controlled the use of it, if we started buying it as herbalist and using it as our tradition, we could go, if it's not harvested in this time period, I'm not taking it, right? And then there's all these ginseng plants that are thrown away too. Because they're not pretty enough to get sent overseas. They're nipped, they're scraped, they're missing the little arm. Why aren't we using those? Because they're just thrown away.
Yeah, that's horrendous. Actually, that's criminal.
It is.
Well, see, we're coming to the end of our time, and I had a couple other things I wanted to ask you. And you know, one of them is you know, when you were first starting your herbal work as an herbalist, What were the challenges that were facing you at that time that you felt were just challenging issues?
Well, it was in my kitchen, and getting the kids to help me clean up the kitchen and then go in their back room and watch TV or play while I talk to a client. So
a lot of it was just that home situation. You have a big family. You have five children, and you also this incredibly busy human being. I mean, I know this personally about you, that your entire community really depends on you for information, education, and herbal remedies, you know. So you had a very busy practice.
That's it, but
and five children.
Yeah, and five kids. But, you know, people otherwise, you know, the nobody ever bothered me. I never had, you know, anybody say anything bad about it, or people just came it. You know, the other thing was, you know, back then, and I've kind of trained my clients now, nobody called. They just showed up knocking on your door. I could be in the middle of cooking supper or getting ready to take my kids to soccer, you know, and somebody would be going, I need to talk to the herbal lady, you know. So those were kind of those extraneous things were more of a challenge. The practice actually was the practice, you know. Never had any problem with any kind of legal issues. I'm knocking on wood. Right. I just did practice and people just came.
So is it still that way, Phyllis, or have you kind of created more of a structure around your herbal work, or do people still knock on the door?
People, a little of both. People are more attentive and will call and say, hey, can I come by? And we set a time, but then I'll get the odd person knocking on the door. I still do.
Yeah. So what do you think are some of the challenges that are facing the younger generation, the herbalists who are coming into it now? Like, you know,
getting enough experience, having a good mentor who has been in practice for a while. Because I'm not seeing as much of that. I'm seeing younger herbalists not having that long mentorship like I did. You know, I had more than one, but being able to sit with an experienced herbalist and watch them in practice and watch how they assess. And I think that's sorely missing.
Yeah, I would say especially in even in the more recent years, because there used to be a lot of apprenticeships where people are in intern programs, but mostly now people are learning online, right? So there's not a lot of, even the herbal conferences and events are not happening so much now because there's so much online information.
That's right.
Not always good information, right?
Right. It's not always good information. And it tends to be the same 15 herbs that, you know, that are considered safe but effective. And there's no practice. There's no oversight. And, you know, one of the things about our traditional herbal medicine is you were an apprentice. It was a journey. You were a journey kind of situation. It was a trade.
Yeah, trade.
Herbalism was a trade. Yeah. And like any other trade, you worked under for a time another herbalist. You follow them around. You have to do their medicine making. But importantly, you learned how to do a session.
Yeah.
You learned how to pick an herb for that person in that situation. Yeah. And a very astute, a smart person who is really into herbalism could figure this out on their own. I'm not saying you couldn't figure it out on your own, but having that is so much better.
Yeah.
Having somebody to work with is so much better.
Yeah, that's very insightful. I tend to really agree with you. I think it's there's so many educational opportunities in schools and programs going on now. But the thing that is lacking is that one-on-one, you know, that internship or apprentice program where people are, you know, in training for a while and getting that hands-on experience, or clinics like going like you did down to Katrina, you know, and actually really just working hands-on with other healers and herbalists. Yeah. So, Lewis, do you have any like just parting words of wisdom to just share with our listeners? Any plant wisdom that you want to just pass on?
Well, I really think that as herbalist, it's important to continue to spread the word about herbalism and the plants. And also, it's also important for us to think about the origin of our plants. Our landscape, our sources of herbalism are changing. We are so much of what I consider my area, the woods are now being turned into cow pastures to raise beef. They're getting houses on them. We're losing our land to modernization, and the land is the home of the plants. So we still have to have this thought of, I think, conservatorship, and that we are conservators of the land, and there's no land, there's no plants. And so then we think about where our plants are coming in from overseas, and there's some really good work done on, you know, where the origin of our plants. And most herb companies now are depending on kind of like European countries or Asian countries that are growing the plants for them. Right. Because instead of like, I'm also a person who believes that if it's our native plant, let's try growing it here first. I'm not saying we can't grow it someplace else, but you know, black co-op should, hey, this is its home. Let's try growing it here in the appropriate environments and having that conservatorship and that connection with the land. So I see a lot of younger herbalists who don't have a connection with the land, but they have a lot of knowledge. And I think kind of that combination is the best. You can certainly do one or the other without, you know, but if you've got that combination of really good educational background, a good understanding of the body, understanding what the plants can do, that only takes you so far.
Yeah.
That's like a doctor only understanding a pharmaceutical drug and what it can do. You're missing part of the picture. It's limiting the use of the herb to what somebody researched, not the herb in all of its glory.
Yeah. That's so true. That's beautiful. Good words of wisdom, my dear. Yeah, it's been so wonderful. I could just listen to you forever. Not only what you share, also that wonderful Southern accent. It's so beautiful to listen to.
Well, so thank you.
Thank you, Phyllis, so much for joining us. And thank you, all of you listening in. If you want to get in touch with Phyllis and find out any about her classes and order her book, you'd go to phyllisdelight.com and you'll find her website. And we also have lots of information up on this podcast that you can find out about where Phyllis is. So thank you, sweetie, so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks wonderful for having me.
Yeah. It was great. It was great. I am there.